It's Diane Rehm. Welcome to On My Mind. Donald Trump became our 45th president 2 weeks ago. It's surely been a dizzying and many would say deeply troubling 14 days. So today I want to take a look at what we know so far about how the Trump administration is operating and how the balance of power among our judicial, executive, and legislative branches may be shifting. First up, David Cole. He's National Legislative Director at the ACLU. He joined me earlier this week to talk about the steps the ACLU is taking against the immigration restrictions President Trump announced last weekend.
This order is designed not to put in place extreme vetting, as he promised during the campaign, but to be an absolute bar.
I wanted to get back with David to hear his reaction to President Trump's Supreme Court nominee, Neil Gorsuch. Hi, David.
Hi, Diane.
Tell us about Neil Gorsuch.
Well, he's a 49-year-old Ivy League educated judge who's been a judge for 10 years on the 10th Circuit. He's out of Colorado. He models himself on Justice Scalia, the seat that he is being he's been nominated to replace. And what that means is that he is committed to originalism as a way of interpreting the Constitution. Namely, we interpret the Constitution as it was understood 200 plus years ago when it was adopted, and not by recognizing the developments and elaborations that have taken place in the interim two centuries.
He did, in fact, clerk for Justice Kennedy and Justice White. Isn't that correct?
That's right. He was a clerk for Justice White, but when Justice White retired, he was essentially lent to Justice Kennedy's chambers, so he worked for both of them.
So would that have perhaps moderated his thinking?
It might have, and I think it's hard to tell, where he will ultimately end up, because he's only been on the court for about 10 years, and he hasn't written all that much outside of the court, where you might get a better sense of his views. But where he has written, it has been in defense of this theory of interpretation, which Justice Scalia holds, Justice Thomas holds. Very few other justices who've ever been on the Supreme Court hold it. Most justices recognize that constitutional law develops over time, that the reason that the Constitution is meaningful for us today and binds us as a nation today is not that a bunch of now long dead old white men with property agreed to it 240 years ago, but rather because it has evolved over time to reflect the fundamental commitments of the people of the United States. And so if you're a real committed originalist, the 14th Amendment doesn't protect women because it was not understood at the time that it was adopted after the Civil War to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex. If you're a committed originalist, the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause doesn't prohibit segregation because the 14th Amendment was adopted by a Congress that was segregated. The seating area was segregated. Nobody said, when we adopt this, that's going to be unconstitutional. And segregation continued for
sure,
decades after that. So that methodology, I think, does raise concerns.
The question of abortion certainly comes up because President Donald Trump promised to appoint someone opposed to Roe v. Wade. How do you see that coming up now, or do you?
Well, I think it's likely to come up. I think the anti-abortion activists have been, buoyed by President Trump's election and are pressing a lot of restrictions on abortion at the state level. And I think with the view, some of them with the view that this will provide an opportunity to reconsider whether Roe versus Wade should be overturned. I don't think in the short term that's on the table because Justice Kennedy signed on in the Casey decision, a decision that declined to overturn Roe versus Wade. And he would, I think, you know, he also signed on to a decision just last year in a case called Whole Woman's Health out of Texas, which applied the Casey decision to strike down a number of anti-abortion restrictions in Texas. He joined the liberal justices in those. So there will still be five votes to maintain a woman's right to choose until the next shoe drops, right?
That is the next appointment. Do you expect that Justice Kennedy at age 80 might see the appointment and, of course, confirmation of Judge Gorsuch as his free move to retire?
This is what everyone is speculating about, right? What will Justice Kennedy do? Because he's a Republican, and so I think, you know, all other things being equal, he'd probably rather be replaced by a Republican president than by a Democratic president. On the other hand, he is a very moderate Republican, and his views on a number of the issues, including especially, I think, gay and lesbian rights, are, you know, at odds with the views of the kind of very right-wing administration that is now in office. And so, the question, I think, will be for Justice Kennedy, well, what is this? What does the appointment of Judge Gorsuch say about who Trump might nominate to replace me? Because I think if he felt that Trump was going to put in somebody who was very, very far right, he might be less inclined to step down. But if he thinks, well, Trump will actually put in someone who's more moderate, then he might be more willing to step down. But the only person who knows the answer to those questions is Justice Kennedy, and he's not talking about that.
Do you have any doubts that Judge Gorsuch will be confirmed?
Well, I think it's a little early to tell, and I think it'll depend on how the hearings go and how hard the Democrats push. But I think that had President Trump selected some other people on his list, including William Pryor, there would have been a much more pitched battle. And whether there will be a battle about Judge Gorsuch, I really just don't know. He doesn't have the kind of record that gives rise to a major battle. But I think the Democrats are also very disturbed by the way the Republicans treated President Obama's selection of Merrick Garland. He also did not have a record that would give rise to any concerns. Everybody agreed he was probably the most qualified person in the country to sit on the court. And it wasn't about Judge Garland. It was about the politics of the court. So I think it remains to be seen.
What are some of the key issues you think will come up this year?
The court has a number of very important cases. One is its first foray into the issue of transgender rights. It's a case arising out of Virginia, a public high school in Virginia, where a transgender boy was barred from using the boys' restroom. And the question is, does that constitute sex discrimination under Title IX, which prohibits schools from drawing lines based on sex? There's another case that involves whether there are constitutional limits on how long you can keep immigrants detained while they are in removal proceedings, even if you have not shown that they pose any kind of danger to the community or flight risk. And the administration, even under Obama, took the position that there really are virtually no limits on how long people can be detained. So you can have somebody who's in an immigration proceeding who poses no danger to the community, who poses no risk of flight, who has a very strong likelihood of winning his case. But simply because the case takes, you know, a year or two to resolve, he or she sits in prison. There's a case before the court this term that will test whether the Constitution imposes limits on how long you can detain people while they're in immigration proceedings. And given President Trump's promise to radically increase the deportation enforcement in the United States, that's, I think, going to be a very significant case involving the rights of foreign nationals. There are also a number of very important voting rights cases about the limits on the legislature's ability to gerrymander districts so that African Americans' votes are counted less, are less effective, so Republican votes are more powerful and the like. So the court has a number of significant cases. It's 4-4 now, but once Judge Gore, and so the controversial cases tend not to often lead to split votes. But now that if Judge Gorsuch is confirmed, he'll join the court and they can hear re-argument in the most controversial cases and have him vote.
David, one last question. As you well know, there are a number of states that have now approved aid in dying. Do I understand correctly that that Judge Gorsuch is very much opposed to that?
Yes, that's the one major piece of writing outside of his judicial opinions that he has. He has a book on euthanasia, and he expresses grave concerns about what he calls any private individual taking the life of another human being is, in his view, always wrong. And that's of concern to people who believe that assistance in dying is a moral and humane way to deal with very difficult end-of-life issues. And it's also of concern to those who want to retain a woman's right to choose to terminate her pregnancy, because depending on how you define human being or human life, that could extend to a choice to terminate a pregnancy as well.
David Cole, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
And now here in the studio with me, Norman Ornstein, the American Enterprise Institute. Norm, let's talk about Congress and Democrats facing pretty tough choices. How do you think they're going to respond?
What we're seeing is the natural Democratic Party instinct, which is to find areas to cooperate. It's a party that wants to govern, and that's why we saw the initial instinct of the Democrats when Trump won was, well, on infrastructure, we could probably find some common ground. There may be a few other things. But after the behavior of the president-elect during that transition time, where he basically kept campaigning and went out on the trail and, stood by benignly while they shouted, lock her up. And then an inaugural address that was very much an in-your-face address aimed at Washington, but certainly with them included. And the behavior since with the executive orders, the left wing of the Democratic Party is furious, outraged, and mobilized in a way we have not seen in decades. Democrats in Congress, including the moderate ones, have become more alienated. And I think we're going to see a lot of moves, especially in the Senate, where they actually have some power to try and use their leverage to at least gain some traction, but if not, to make statements.
At the same time, would you agree with Paul Kane, who wrote in the Washington Post that this fight over Trump's Supreme Court nominee has the power to forever reshape the Senate?
Absolutely, it does. You know, we have to take into account that this is not the first step. This is the culmination of a deterioration of the norms in the Senate that I would attribute primarily to Mitch McConnell. And going right back to the beginning of the Obama administration, we know his famous comment, my number one goal is to make Barack Obama one-term president. Even more significant was a statement he made after their great success in the midterm elections in 2010, when McConnell said, well, of course we weren't going to cooperate with them. We wanted to throw every roadblock in the way, in effect, is what he said, because if they had made policies that people liked and they had a patina of bipartisanship, the president and the Democrats would have gained from them. That kind of an attitude, which played itself out with a shattering of the fundamental norms of the Senate, the filibuster, which had been used very, very rarely up to that point, began to be used on almost everything, nominations not that were sincerely opposed by Republicans, many that passed unanimously or near unanimously, bills where they didn't have significant dissension, but just to delay things. You know, we called it the filibuster as a weapon of mass obstruction. Every time you deny unanimous consent in the Senate, you then have to go through a whole series of hurdles that take an enormous amount of time. And doing this as a weapon to bollocks up the floor, taking every policy that passed and delegitimizing it, those were tactics that had not been seen except in very odd moments, and they became routine. And then when we saw that the Republicans refused to countenance any nominee, no matter what the qualifications, for the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the critical court, so that they could maintain a conservative majority, despite vacancies, despite the fact that even the Chief Justice said these positions should be filled, that forced Harry Reid to change the rules on the filibuster. And that was another step down the path of having norms disappear. And now, you know, we have a vast wasteland in the Senate, and it's going to move even further in that direction.
But, Norm, what happened to those Republicans who disagreed with Trump during the campaign, who really came out and opposed his candidacy, and certainly now seem to have fallen in line?
We've talked many times before, Diane, about what I have defined as partisan tribalism. We know we have different and distinct ideologies in our parties and that we have polarized very significantly. But it's become, over a number of years, tribal in nature. And that tribal instinct, which plays itself out more in opposition to the other side and a belief that they're the enemy and not just an adversary, has another element to it, which is that you crouch down and support your person even if you dislike that person because it's your tribe. Republicans have more of a tendency to do that than Democrats. I think it's built into their culture. But there's another factor we need to take into account. Trump's approval rating, we know, you know, take it on average, give him 40%. It's historically low for an incoming president. You might think on that basis that his own party members would look at that and say, I want more distance from him. But if you look, and we've now seen surveys, at his approval in congressional districts Republicans hold, it's 85%. And if you look in districts that Democrats hold among Republicans, it's 80%. And in the states, the red states, which is still where a majority of the Republicans in the Senate come from, their base, the people who would turn out in primaries, the people who contribute to their campaigns, the ones who are going to go to their town meetings and give them hell, they're still behind Donald Trump.
So what does that mean as far as the immigration ban is concerned? You saw lots of people, thousands of people come out at airports around the country. Do those shows of dissent mean anything?
Well, we began to see at least some Republicans get a little distance on this issue, but it took a while. I mean, what was so striking about this was there was an immediate reaction around the country and spontaneous and enormous demonstrations in New York and Washington and Los Angeles and the places where airports are, where there are international flows of people. We saw these heartrending stories of individuals and families being torn apart, and in particular, those who had green cards, those who had valid visas, and in some instances, people who were detained even if they came from a country that was not one of the seven on the list we're now seeing. And we had radio silence from the vast majority of Republicans. But more significantly, we got a very early expression of support for the policy from the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and then from Mitch McConnell, the two leaders. And when we began to see some dissent, for most of the ones who were dissenting, it was, well, I support the policy overall. They just did it really badly. And that, again, is a reflection of where the Republican base is and the reluctance of many, maybe most, Republicans in Congress to take on their base, even if during the campaign, they said very different things.
Was there buy-in or agreement from other parts of the government on this policy before he put it into place?
You know, there are a couple of elements of this beyond the substance and the enormous heartaches caused by this policy and the, you know, blowback that we're going to get around the world that I found particularly troubling as a student of the institutions and as somebody who's been very close to them. We know now that the Secretary of Homeland Security was on the phone while on a plane expressing his great misgivings about the program and especially about these elements, including the green card. And while he was on the phone, an aide came up to him and said, too late, they've signed the executive order. And it now appears, there are a number of news stories saying that Steve Bannon basically overrode that and said, keep the green card ban in there, which made it kind of amusing when Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, at a news conference said, well, nobody wanted a ban on the green card people, when, of course, it was directly ordered by them. At the same time, and from a congressional institutional perspective, more unsettling, members of the House Judiciary Committee staff were brought into the White House to consult on this, were made to sign non-disclosure agreements. We still don't know for sure whether the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte, approved of this, knew about it in advance. What we do know is that the rest of the congressional Republicans were completely in the dark about this. And the idea that your own staffers are going to be used to do a policy in which you have played no role, if under normal, and I use that word loosely, circumstances, congressional leaders would go to DEFCON 1.
What does all this tell you about Steve Bannon and the role he is now playing?
We know that the inaugural address, which was a populist, in-your-face, isolationist speech, was written basically by Steve Bannon and Steve Miller, who's a young policy guy inside the White House. That kind of set a tone. And it now appears that Bannon is a dominant figure inside the White House. And the fact that the president is signing executive orders that appear to be written fundamentally by Bannon and Miller, and that they are very deliberately not bringing in the Office of Legal Counsel in the Justice Department, which has always been routine. You want to check to see if the executive orders are legal, if they meet a whole set of criteria in terms of previous actions. They're not doing that. They are either refusing to consult with cabinet people or others who are experts in these areas. And now the idea that Bannon will be made an integral part of the national security-making process, which is itself unprecedented, a political aide being a part of the Principals Committee, tells you that Bannon is a, if not the key player, first among equals, and it certainly appears to be more than that.
Norm, I want to ask you about a number of commentators who've said that President Trump actually poses a threat to our country. Commentators like David Brooks, Elliot Cohen, Max Boot, and David Frum. What do you make of this?
You know, we're not talking about people who are prone to apocalyptic rhetoric, but they see signs that we could be moving towards a more authoritarian state. And
what does that mean, Norm?
It means a disdain for the normal governing process. It means that the rules that you operate under don't apply. It means that you go after your opposition in
your
a fashion
enemies.
As enemies. It means that you try to isolate the press and intimidate the press and ultimately maybe handcuff the press. It means that you pit one group of citizens against another. And ultimately, it can mean that you say that the threat to the nation is so great that you're going to have to suspend some civil liberties. Now, you know, we might say we're 10 days into a new administration. You know, let's not go overboard here. There's always a period of adjustment. But the early signs are not very positive ones. And the fact that the normal checks and balances that we would hope would be there, especially from the Congress, don't appear to be there anymore.
And you have written the book, The Broken Branch, referring to the Congress. It sounds as though they're already in that place where they're even more broken than they were to begin with.
I'm troubled by what I see. And one of the things people ask me about all the time, have we ever had anything like this before? And, you know, I've been around a long time. I was here in 1973, 74, when we went through the enormous crisis with Richard Nixon. I went to the White House the evening that Archibald Cox, the independent counsel who was investigating Watergate and the wrongdoing in the administration, was fired after the attorney general and the deputy attorney general resigned and wouldn't do it before they went down the line to find somebody, the solicitor general, who would. When we had a question of whether President Nixon would be forced to release the tapes that he had that included all the incriminating information. And what struck me at the time was, look at the safeguards we have in our system, because we feared that we could see a coup or we could see a military takeover or whatever. We had a Supreme Court that ruled unanimously turn over those tapes. We had people like Howard Baker and Hugh Scott and Barry Goldwater in the Senate. They were partisans, but they did what was the right institutional duty. They investigated, they looked at where this was going, and they built a body of evidence that ultimately led to the impeachment process moving forward. And then you had a group of senior Republicans who went to Richard Nixon and said, for the good of the nation, you need to resign. So we had people who had inculcated the appropriate norms of behavior to protect the system. And I look out there now, Diane, and I'm just not sure we have that anymore. And that is chilling.
Are you suggesting that the moves that Donald Trump is making, as these commentators are saying, could lead to something as close to impeachment as what happened with Richard Nixon?
Well, you know, there's a lot of speculation about that. I would temper it just by saying we have an administration filled with people who've never been in or close to government before. One of the unsettling things to me is that you have a president coming in who hasn't surrounded himself with people who know how the process works or the system works.
And perhaps don't care.
And a lot of them want to blow everything up, which fits the campaign and fits what many of their constituents and voters would like. But there could be a shakeup down the road, and it may be that Trump turns out to be the pragmatic deal maker that some believe he is. Maybe we'll see new people come in. Maybe some of the more sane forces will ultimately take control. It's too early to make a definitive projection. But everything that we've seen early on is unsettling. And, you know, one other point I would make. In my almost 50 years in Washington, I've gotten to know some presidents, and I've watched the ones I didn't know very well very, very closely. What struck me with all of them, and that includes the ones who had incredibly deep experience, George Herbert Walker Bush, who had been the vice president for 8 years and had, you know, served in Congress, been an ambassador, been head of the CIA, all kinds of things. The moment he got elected as president, he changed. All of a sudden, there's this understanding that you have this immense responsibility for 300 million Americans and for billions of people around the world, where you are the most important figure, and you're changed. Everybody was changed by the presidency, except Donald Trump. The day after the election, he was no different than he was the day before. Into his presidency, after being sworn in, his inaugural address and the actions taken since then, the tweets that he continues to do, the people he goes after, There's nothing that suggests anything other than that he wants to change the presidency and change the political system to fit himself, and that's unsettling.
One last question, Norm. You mentioned handcuffing the press. How could an administration do that?
Well, if you take it to its most frightening conclusions, you use the IRS or the Justice Department or the other machinery of government to go after those elements of the press you don't like. We've seen baby steps already taken. We've seen now, the sort of foolishness of a president saying, I don't like what CNN is saying, so my spokespeople are not going on the network anymore. We've seen direct attacks by the president against the New York Times and other outlets he doesn't like. We've seen Sean Spicer, his press spokesman, go after the press corps and basically accuse them of dire things. We've heard them talk about shutting out the press, taking them away from a role of being around the president, of moving away from daily briefings, of moving them from their place in the White House to a spot that's no longer as close by, of replacing those who have been the main figures, like the Associated Press in the press room, with outlets that are basically flacks for the president. You know, there are small steps you can take. There are things you can say that are intimidating. You can talk about the press as the president did, as the enemy. They are the opposition. All of those are steps along the way towards what could be something significantly more chilling.
Norm Ornstein, thank you.
You bet, Diane. And I'm so glad that you're back in the fray.
You gotta do it. And last Sunday, a column by Dana Milbank at the Washington Post caught my attention. We spoke earlier this week. Dana Milbank, welcome.
Thank you, Diane.
Your piece in Sunday's Washington Post is titled, It's Terrifying When It's Always Sunny, all about statements made by Donald Trump. You argue raise concerns about his mental state of health. Talk about that.
Right. Look, I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't make any, professional judgment on his state of mind. I mean, obviously, we've heard all kinds of people talk about the narcissistic personality disorder. I'm not going to play pop psychologist, but I was there at the inauguration. I was in the sixth row watching the inaugural address. And then a day later, I was listening to our president speaking to the CIA when he said, there were a few drops of rain when I started giving the address.
Well, I said it was almost raining.
And then it got really sunny out.
In fact, when I first started, I said, oh, no. First line, I got hit by a couple of drops. And I said, oh, this is too bad, but we'll go right through it. But the truth is that
and
it
I
stopped
thought,
immediately.
It did not get really sunny out. It was cloudy the entire time and raining. So I had our people at the Washington Post pull the radar weather and the satellite maps. And indeed, there was nothing of the sort, of course. This is what I'm worried about with Donald Trump. It's not any one thing that he's doing. I mean, certainly a number of things are alarming. What I think is fairly being called the Muslim ban and various other of the
events over the weekend,
yeah, sure.
Which raised protests.
Of course, and the whole world is sort of in a bit of a panic about this. So it's been an extraordinary 10 days. To me, what's equally worrying is not what's been done, but the way it's been done and the way the president is talking about these things. So why is he making up things about the size of the inaugural crowd? What is to be gained by that with the Muslim order? It's not just about releasing the order, but also making up some cockamamie story about it being the same thing that President Obama had done. So the question is, why is this occurring? And is the president, does he feel the need to lie? But I'm not sure it is lying, because lying implies that he knows what the truth is and he's deciding to do otherwise. I think there is another possibility here, and he believes it because he just said it. And others have made this observation before. And indeed, the guy who co-wrote with him the Art of the Deal, said Trump is just extraordinary at believing that whatever he said is true, or at least ought to be true, regardless of whether, in fact, it is. That's the alarming thing, that he may just believe whatever it is that he said.
He has raised real questions about the popular vote and has put in motion an investigation. Is that all part of the concern you have?
There's concerns on multiple levels there. I mean, you could say, okay, is he doing that, which is entirely possible, to distract from other things? So we're all going to be nattering about the size of the inauguration when, let's face it, who cares? It doesn't really matter how many people were there at the inauguration. And while we're going on with that, all these other, you know, executives' orders are being made. The basically large swaths of the federal government are having gag orders put in place so they can no longer communicate with the public. But we're focusing on this outrageous thing that the president said. So that is a possibility, that it's a deliberate strategy to distract attention. And the other possibility, or they could be true concurrently, is the president looked out there and he said, I think there's 1.5 million people there. And he decided that that's the fact. And he ordered his Park Service director to prove that what he believed he saw is in fact what was seen.
You know, I have read and heard the term gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean to you?
That does seem to be in vogue these days. It's, I think a newer word for it now is alternative facts.
You know, Dana, Scotty Nell Hughes, a Trump supporter and CNN contributor, she used a similar phrase on the Diane Rehm show on November 30th.
And so one thing that has been interesting this entire campaign season to watch is that people that say facts are facts, they're not really facts. Everybody has a way. It's kind of like looking at ratings or looking at a glass of half full water. Everybody has a way of interpreting them to be the truth or not truth. There's no such thing, unfortunately, more of facts.
And so people around the table said their jaws dropped wide open.
Right. I mean, I think that's interesting to recall because, you know, so that means it didn't just burst on the scene when Kellyanne Conway said it on Meet the Press. This is something they've been batting around for a while here. They mean it seriously, that there's another set of facts out there. But, of course, everybody else hears it as there are the facts, and then we're just going to have an alternative to that.
So, Dana, what does that mean for you? Is it a form of lying? Should the press be talking about lying or focusing on Donald Trump and the way he thinks?
The question of deciding whether somebody is lying or not, you need to know two things. One is what they're saying true or false? Okay, we know this is false. The other thing is we need to know what the motive is there. So you could say something false just not knowing the truth, being misinformed. You could be lying in the sense that you're intentionally not telling the truth. But there is this third possibility here, and the truth in Donald Trump's mind is whatever the last thing he said is. Now, I don't think that's true for Sean Spicer or Kellyanne Conway. So to me, it's less important, you know, what you label it, as long as you label it false. Rather than guess at people's motives, just say the president of the United States is saying things that are just not true.
Are you concerned that the president does not know the difference between truth and what's in his own mind?
Well, that's, of course, the most alarming possibility, and you know, people have raised this earlier during the campaign. I wrote it about it a bit. You know, my colleague Jennifer Rubin, who is a conservative blogger, has actually talked about, you know, there may be the need to invoke the 25th Amendment, where Mike Pence gets together with congressional leaders and say, this man is not in a mental capacity where he's fit to serve. I don't think anybody's anywhere near that point right now. But obviously, if you can't distinguish what is true from what you'd like to be true, that creates all kinds of problems for international crises and constitutional crises. But
a conference call with reporters last night, a quote senior administration official said of the a havoc going on at airports around the country, that the restriction on certain populations coming into this country is really a massive success story in terms of implementation on every single level. I don't get this, Dana.
See, Diane, that to me is what administrations do when you have something that is very clearly a failure, and they just get up there and say, it's terrific, it's exactly what we intended. I would almost say that's in the category of spinning. So, I mean, I'm not saying that's acceptable and people ought to, you know, spout such nonsense, but it's very different from saying black is white, day is night. So they're interpreting, saying, no, this is much better than meets the eye. And we can all sit back and say that's nonsense. But it's very different from saying there were 1.5 million people there because I said so, and that's the fact.
Or the sun was shining and I said right. So.
Right, because then what happens when the president says North Korea just fired a nuclear missile at us? It's not true. I mean, what happens then?
Dana, what about during the campaign when he talked about Ted Cruz and the involvement his father might have had in the assassination of John F. Kennedy?
It's interesting to think back to what Cruz was saying at the time, because now, of course, since the Republican convention, Ted Cruz has come around and he's a big fan of Donald Trump. But he did, I believe, that what he said back at the time was a sort of a pathological liar, and saying virtually everything out of his mouth is a lie.
He doesn't know the difference between truth and lies. He lies practically every word that comes out of his mouth.
And Cruz went on to say that Trump's response when called on this is to say everybody else is a liar.
In a pattern that I think is straight out of a psychology textbook, his response is to accuse everybody else of lying.
That last part we obviously see going on, because, you know, basically the press has been in an operation of fact-checking this president. He turns around and says it's the dishonest press, which has that unfortunate echo of the lying press from an earlier era in Germany. So, you know, that sends chills down all of our
indeed
spines.
And, of course, the New York Times the other day used the word lies on the front mm-hmm. page. Do you see the Washington Post taking that same tack?
I don't know. I'm not part of those conversations at the Post. I'm not sure I agree with it, not for the reason that I'm defending what Trump said, but because of what we've been discussing earlier, and that I'm not so sure that it is deliberate in the sense that he may very well believe what he's saying. So by the textbook definition, that's not a lie. It's something worse. So in a way, saying Trump is lying, I think eliminates that other possibility that Trump does not know the truth from fiction, and that's more worrying to me than a president who knows the truth and is just trying to get around it.
Dana Milbank, his piece, It's Terrifying When It's Always Sunny, appeared in the January 29th Washington Post. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you, Diane.
And we'll leave it at that. So much food for thought this week. Thanks to David Cole of the ACLU, Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute, and Dana Milbank of the Washington Post for sharing their thoughts with us. And I look forward to your feedback. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our music was composed by Cliff Harden and used courtesy of WAMU's Capital Soundtrack Project. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. This is Diane Rehm. I'll talk to you next week.
WAMU's Diane Rehm will host a cruise around Cuba in April for 8 days and 7 nights. The trip will take you to Havana, Trinidad, coastal towns, and a tobacco farm. Walking tours, artist studios, and local music are included. More information is at drshow.org.